Well, at some point, living out loud does go beyond having real friendships. You know, it does go beyond being an authentic person in our life. At some point, living out loud starts to look kind of like what those guys were wrestling with. You know, most of us are getting to that place in life where we're starting to wonder a little bit, maybe there's something more to this thing than just the job, or maybe there's something more to this thing than just these relationships. Maybe there's something more to life, and I wonder what that is. And so we're at the place where we're starting to ask some of those real hard questions. You know, things like, you know, what is life all about? You know, why am I here? Why is Mike Brown still here? Why doesn't somebody do something about this? A lot of those things that just tend to start to keep you up at night if you think about them too much. At some point, living out loud becomes asking some hard questions. And you know, one of the cool things is we've got folks in here this morning that are all over the spectrum spiritually as far as questions that they're wrestling with and where they are in their journeys. There's some of you in here right now, you don't even believe that there is a God, or you're asking some questions of could God exist in the first place. You know, to you, I want to tell you, this needs to be a safe place for you to ask those kind of questions. We think that it's so cool that you're here. As a matter of fact, that's why we started Crossroads, to be a safe place where we all could wrestle through honest questions like that. Some of you in here will end up finding that Crossroads is not the best place for wrestling with your questions, and your journey will take you somewhere else. Others in here will find that this is a sweet spot in your life, a safe place to ask some dangerous questions for the first time. What I want to look at today is, regardless of where you find yourself on that continuum, honest questions, if you're going to be a seeker of truth, you need to wrestle with. Whether you continue to wrestle with them here at Crossroads, or you go elsewhere or somewhere else on your journey, you need to take these questions with you. They're kind of three questions that seekers of truth ask when they start to get really real with their honest questions about God. First one I want to take a look at is actually one you'll probably hear and you'll say, well, you know, that's a no-brainer. That's, you know, kind of not this big truth that I need to wrestle with. But I want to challenge you that it's one we often blow right past. The question is truth bigger than me? Is truth bigger than me? Now, this is one that we can kind of nod our head to and say, yeah, you know, that's a no-brainer. But the fact is, most of us live our lives as if truth is entirely just within ourselves. You know, it's kind of what I would call planet me. You know, that it's all about me, and if there's truth, it's within me. Reminds me kind of babies. You know, how completely self-absorbed babies are. Now, I want to be careful here. I'm not coming out anti-baby. You know, I'm not making a statement against babies. I love babies. I was a baby once myself. Some of my best friends are babies, as a matter of fact. Nancy and I love babies so much that we've made two of them, you know, but to be honest with you, we are a little tired, and Daddy's going to the doctor next week, and we're going to move on with our lives, you know. Why are you clapping for my vasectomy? What? You know, others of you, you can just put a little column on your paper there that says information I didn't need to know, you know, and just keep a list. Babies are just totally about themselves, though, and it's a self-preservation technique for them. But one of the things we do when we mature into adulthood is we're to step out of that. But more often than not, what we find ourselves doing, instead of moving beyond that planet me worldview, what we end up doing is we start finding clever ways to disguise it and still have the same force that's driving us. Different creative ways to kind of scratch that itch. And I found more than a few ways in my life to scratch that itch. I know one time in particular, I think I was in college. I actually was president of my fraternity in college, which fraternities are an interesting thing. You know, the concept is, let's take, you know, 120 guys between the ages of 18 to 21, you know, pulsing with hormones, away from school for the first time, legal drinking age, put them all in a house together and expect something good to come of it. You know, it's just interesting concept. Well, what happened was, I was president of my fraternity, 130 guys, Phi Kappa Psi at the University of Illinois. Now, it was less of an honor than really, we just got in a room and decided I would be the best person to bluff the police if they came to the front door. So that was, you know, kind of how I ended up in that. But there were some perks that came along with being president. You see, when everything in the fraternity was decided on seniority, of when you were initiated into the house. But there was one exception. That was during your term as president, your seniority number became one. So you were number one. Your number trumped everyone. So you got the best choice of everything. You got the best choice of room selection, the best furniture that you wanted. You got the first pick of parking spaces, you know, kind of everything. And particularly with the pledges, you know, you could come in the room and just call out your number one, and they'd have to get out of the seat that you wanted to be in. They'd have to get away from the pool table. You know, they'd have to give you their girlfriend, you know, whatever that happened to be. That last one, no, not quite. You could kind of trump that. And you got into this thing where it was so focused on who was kind of number one in the seniority that everything revolved around them. And often we would have these big all-campus parties, and we would move this big mahogany table out into the lobby. And then at one point in the party, they would... I still don't understand this completely, but we would turn off all the lights and they would start playing Iron Man. Does anyone know what Iron Man? Every time, na 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 na. Yeah, that's it. Only a few were brave enough to raise your hands. They start jamming Iron Man. Strobe lights would come on, and then they would take the president and they would throw you up on the table, and then you were to you stomped around during Iron Man while they played it and chanted, and you said, "I am God. I am God." Oh, like you were all proud of everything you did in the 80s. Please. It's a time of exploration, you know? L.A. Law was on. You know, it was all about that. Well, you know what? In some little bubble there, I was able to tell myself that it was all about me. You start to find socially acceptable disguises for this planet me thing. And the cost of that is you stop looking for truth outside of yourself. And you start assuming that maybe all truth is at least your size or a little smaller. And that if there is truth, you don't stop to consider that maybe it's outside of you and maybe it's bigger and stranger than you ever thought. And God says that's a place we need to get to if we're going to start to ask honest questions that are based in reality. As a matter of fact, here's how God describes himself in the Old Testament book of Isaiah, in the Bible. Isaiah 55, 8, 9, he says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." You know, one of the first steps on the path of truth-seeking is that we realize I am not the center of reality. That if there is such a thing as truth, it just might be bigger than me. You know, when you stop to think about it, do you really think that there's nothing deep down inside you except what you put there? Do you really think there's nothing deep down inside you except what you put there? And if so, how come the accomplishments start to get piled up and the defining thread of accomplishments in your life is you come out of it with a taste for more? If there's nothing down inside you except what you put there, how come no matter how many friends and how many relationships you pile around you and how large of parties that you go to, when you go to bed at the end of the night, you still feel alone? If there's nothing else down inside you except what you put there, how come you can get all the education, read more and more books, and your life is primarily defined with more questions than ever? It's because one of the first steps to being a truth seeker is we need to look beyond ourselves for answers. The fact is, that taste for more accomplishment, that aloneness you may feel, those questions, they're not bad. They're not things we should hide from. They're not things we should try to deny or disguise, but they are symptoms. They are symptoms that there's something deep down inside of you besides what you put there. They're symptoms that you are incurably spiritual. We are spiritual beings, and something's deep down inside us that we did not put there, and truth is larger than us. That's the first question. Is truth bigger than me? And there's a second one. It starts to get a little bit stickier now, I'll warn you. The second real question we need to take with us wherever we go is, if there is truth, is there also false? If there is such a thing as truth, is there also the possibility that there's such a thing as false? Now, this is where it starts to get a little bit more challenging for us. Because I think most of us have somehow grown up and adopted some version of this view of reality. That what matters is how sincerely you believe. And that's the only thing that matters. That I believe what I believe, you believe what you believe, and they're both true. As long as, and here's the caveat we put on it, I can believe whatever I want to believe, you can believe whatever you want to believe, they're both true, as long as we're both sincere. As long as we're both sincere. So truth becomes, the complete definition of truth is just sincerely believing in something. As a matter of fact, truth is just sincerely believing in anything. Even if we believe things that are completely contradictory to each other, even if we believe things that are completely opposite to each other, we're both true. They're both true as long as we're both sincere. So all that's necessary for truth is that someone believes it. And you know what? We've got good reasons for this. I mean, there are some real solid reasons why we have elevated sincerity to such a preeminent place in the equation of truth. One of the biggest reasons is what we covered during the whole last series we did here, House of Hypocrites. The fact is, sincerity has risen so high on our list because we are sick of hypocrites. And we are particularly tired of the church being at the cutting edge of this thing. We are tired of hypocrites, and we have no room for listening to somebody who's not sincere and lives according to what they talk. And another reason that sincerity has risen so high in the ranks is we are all tired of pain and suffering being inflicted in the name of God. And so sincerity, as the only definition of truth, becomes a very appealing thing. Because we're tired of the abuse. We're tired of the Middle East. We're tired of Bosnia. We're tired of Northern Ireland. We're tired of Cincinnati. But in our pursuit of peace, we take a step that's illogical. We say that to have peace, we need to deny that any differences exist in the first place. In the pursuit of comfort and peace, we say that there's no differences anyway. And it gives us some kind of shortcut to comfort or peace, helps us sleep at night, but the long-term cost is logic and truth. You see, I cannot say to my Buddhist friend, I believe that the Bible tells me that there is a God and he's personal and he wants a personal relationship with us, and you could say that there is no such thing as a God and we're both true. I can't do that. I can say I respect you for holding your belief. I want to protect your right to hold that belief, but I cannot say we both are true just so that we can get along together. We've got to find a way to respect and honor and get along when we have differences. See, what happens if truth is completely relative, if you can have your truth and even if it's completely opposite of mine, I can have mine, a nice thing happens. When I choose A and you choose B, we could say we're both right and there's no disagreement. And it's easier. But in the process, we've lost the ability to distinguish between two important concepts: pluralism and relativism. I'm going to take a look at pluralism here. What pluralism is, it's protecting and respecting the rights of every person to hold their beliefs without fear of persecution. Pluralism is absolutely critical to our country. It's absolutely critical to our society. And pluralism is such a staple that we need to work hard to value it and to actively protect it in our communities. Pluralism is what has protected our Muslim neighbors in the United States from retribution in the last year. Pluralism is what's protected them from somebody going out and saying, you can't worship what you want to worship because of what happened on 9/11. Pluralism is something we absolutely need to protect. But see, relativism makes this huge leap. It says that not only do we need to vigorously protect each other's right to believe, but because we need to protect each other's right to believe, all of us are right. Everything is truth. There's no such thing as false. See, relativism says all beliefs are equally true, even if they are opposite. Not all beliefs are equally respected and protected, but all beliefs are equally true, even if they're opposite. And what happens when we can slip into that is we don't have to learn to live responsibly. We can just deny that any differences exist in the first place. I've got my way to God, you've got your way to God. But what's preeminently important here is that neither one of us acts like we have the truth. And you know, this is not something new. It's not something that's just kind of come up in the last 30 years. This has been a temptation that's been going on as long as man's been around. I mean, take a look in ancient Greece. A guy by the name of Protagoras. Protagoras said that whatever anyone believes is true. He said, because of all the different divergent beliefs out there, I want to make a statement that as whatever you want to believe, that's true for you. And then whatever you want to believe, that's true for you. Whatever anyone believes is true. Well, one of Protagoras' contemporaries at the time was Socrates. And Socrates says, Protagoras, whatever anyone wants to believe is true, okay, fine. I believe you're wrong. I mean, we start to commit intellectual suicide when we slip into relativism from pluralism. But it's such a temptation, and often with good motives, because we're tired of the hate. We're tired of the pain. But we can't find ourselves drifting into the place where we say that everything's true then. There was a Harvard student who was chosen to do the graduation address, commencement address at Harvard. And he actually talked about this in kind of a sarcastic way of what he had been taught during his time at Harvard. Here's what he said. He said, the freedom of our day is the freedom to devote ourselves to any values we please on the one condition that we do not believe them to be true. You know what? We cannot commit intellectual suicide in the name of comfort. I mean, where else does this idea that you have your truth, I have my truth, and even if they're opposite, they can both be true, where else in life does this reflect reality? You know, I want to skate a little bit further out on the ice here. Being sincere is good. Being sincere is admirable. Being sincere is absolutely necessary in your quest for God. But it does not guarantee that you're right. You can be sincerely wrong. I've talked before about a short time that I spent in Bucharest, Romania, after the Eastern Bloc dictatorship had been overthrown there. Went over there with a group of craftsmen and tradesmen from Cincinnati who are committed to helping rebuild the infrastructure of the capital city of Romania, Bucharest, after Ceausescu had raped and pillaged it for, you know, 30-some years or so. So we went over there with a commitment to help rebuild the infrastructure of the orphanages, the street missions, the churches, things like that. First day there, one of the main things I was struck by just was the number of kids in the street. Just everywhere, because Ceausescu had wanted families to have as many children as possible, move them all into the city so he could build up his army. But then what he ended up with is all these street kids who lived underground in the sewers and they would come out at night. And so we had all these kids swarming the street when they were working. And the first day, one kid in particular started to hang out with me and follow me everywhere I was going. As it turned out, he wasn't an orphan. He was actually, his parents lived nearby. But he was an interesting little boy. He was probably, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5. And one of his eyes was crossed. It was permanently crossed. He followed me around all day, and I ended up asking somebody that night. I said, hey, that little boy that was following me around all day, you know, what happened to him? He said, it's a sad story. When he was an infant, he contracted some illness, and he got an incredibly high fever, and they didn't know what to do about it. So his parents took him to this kind of makeshift neighborhood doctor, and they gave him some medicine to help bring the fever down. But they accidentally gave him an adult dosage instead of an infant dosage of this medicine. And he had all kind of physical ramifications that happened, but really the one long-term one is that his eye is locked. It's permanently crossed. You know, I ended up meeting those parents a couple days later. Ended up getting to know them, and they are wonderful people. And those wonderful people sincerely, sincerely wanted to help their baby boy. That doctor, that makeshift local doctor, he wasn't trying to do anything but help. He sincerely wanted to help. And those parents and that doctor sincerely reached for the wrong medicine. They were sincerely wrong. In every area of life, you can be sincerely wrong. I mean, do you think that not a single one of all those Nazis marching for Hitler were sincere? Do you think that not a single one of the thousand or so that joined the People's Temple and drank the poison Kool-Aid in Guyana, do you think not a single one of them were sincere? Do you think that not a single one of these suicide bombers in the last couple of years in Jerusalem have been sincere? You can be sincerely wrong. Whether it's with medicine or your quest for God, it can happen. You know, one of the really cool things I thought has happened in the last year was what happened right after 9/11. And the fact that one of the first instincts of our country that kicked in was to protect the rights of our Muslim neighbors to worship as they believed, without fear of retribution. And to protect that right, and to make sure that nobody kind of tried to exact revenge on them in some twisted way. And I remember thinking about this and driving past the mosque in Cincinnati on September 12th. And the first thing I saw was a police car out at the entrance. I thought, what a cool thing. What a cool thing that one of the first instincts of our country, while we're still bleeding, was to protect the rights of those who believe differently. Was to kick in and say that we're going to make sure that some wacko doesn't try to exact revenge in some weird way here. I think that's been a really cool thing that our country has demonstrated in the last year. But I do want to be totally real with you here. There's been something else that's happened in the last year that has been really perplexing. It's because we've so had our world rocked. We so want to go back to normalcy, whatever that was. We have such a thirst for it to go back to peace and comfort that in the process, a lot of good people are painting over any differences between Islam and Christianity. And it's often with very good motives. Because they don't want to see the hate. But in the midst of that, some very well-meaning people have started to commit intellectual suicide. They've started to say that there's no difference here. They've started to say that it's not that I have my beliefs, my Muslim neighbor has their beliefs, we disagree, I believe I have truth, and I need to learn to respect them. No, instead, we need to paint over the differences and say, there's no differences in the first place. That really, Jesus and Muhammad are kind of just different flavors of the same coffee. And so they can read where Jesus told us to love our neighbors as ourselves. And where Muhammad says, try to convert them to worship Allah. And in the end, if they don't, you can use force. Folks, this is in the Quran, and it is not the same. Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, yeah, they're all basically the same. Except what they feel, believe, and teach about creation, man, heaven, hell, sin, God, death, and what happens when you die. Other than that, yeah. I'm not telling you today what to pick. I'm just telling you, do not commit intellectual suicide. There are differences. Where else does the idea that I have my truth and you have your truth, and even if they're totally different, they're both fine, where else does this reflect reality? We wouldn't hire a surgeon to cut us open who believed that anesthesia was true for some people but not true for others. But yet at the same time, we see the Bible tell us a man to love his wife as himself, and we see Muhammad in the Quran tell husbands that if they suspect disobedience, as a final resort, they can beat their wives. And we try to say they're both the same. We would never fly on an airplane that the engineer said, you know what, this gravity thing, true for some but not for me, I'm going to ignore it. But yet we hear followers of Christ talk about grace, and then our Hindu friends talk about, no, it's about working as absolute hard as you can so that slowly, over lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, you are reincarnated in different forms. And we try to say they're the same. We wouldn't even hire a plumber who tells us that flushing is true for some but not for others. But yet we look in the Bible that talks about a personal God who wants a relationship with us, and our Buddhist friends believe that there is no God, and we try to say they're the same. I'm not trying to convince you one way or the other this morning. I'm just asking you to make sure you think. And you know what? Right now, there are some in here that have been going to church for a long time, and you're sitting there and you're saying, yeah, tell them. You know what? I want to tell you, I'm talking to you and me as well as the rest of us. Because there's some people who've been in church their whole life and they think they've just inherited truth from their parents. And you have never wrestled with the real honest questions. And you know what one of your worst nightmares is? That somebody that doesn't believe what you believe will challenge you and you won't have answers for them because you expect that it's just been handed down to you. And you have no greater right to say you believe in the truth than anybody else does because you've never wrestled with the questions. And the healthiest thing you could do this morning is take a step back from your belief and start to wrestle with the hard questions. You see, we need to look not only for sincerity, but sincerity plus truth. Because sincerity is important. Sincerity is critical. But whether you're reaching for medicine or for God, you can be sincerely wrong. Our emphasis needs to be not only on sincerity, but on the validity of what we're believing in the first place. Which is why God talks about it this way in the book of Proverbs in the Bible. It says, there is a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death. There are ways that can seem right, but if we don't dig into them, they can take us to the wrong place. Not only do we have to ask ourselves, is truth bigger than me? Not only do we have to ask ourselves, if there's truth, is there also false? There's one more question that we need to take with us wherever we go. Is truth always comfortable? Is truth always comfortable? See, it comes down to the fact that, yeah, we all want comfort, but what are you looking for at all expenses? Are you looking for comfort at all expenses, or are you looking for truth at all expenses? See, I think sometimes we can find ourselves defining our quest for truth as just looking for things that we like. So we kind of become like this person who's just staring into a mirror, and we're looking for this kind of magic mirror that won't reflect reality to us, but will tell us whatever we want to hear, will show us whatever we want to see, whether it's reality or not. You know, I think in our quieter moments, we would admit that we've all spent a good deal of our lives looking for the mirror. Not necessarily looking for truth. Looking for partial truth. Looking for comfortable truth. Something that, by definition, won't challenge us. Something, by definition, won't ask us to change. And it's not that truth is always uncomfortable. It's the fact that we do not find truth if we disallow the possibility of it being uncomfortable. One of the top financial analysts at Kidder Peabody and Company for years was a guy by the name of Jay Friedman. And I read an interview with him once where they were asking him what his secret was to determining the value of a company and to picking stocks right. And he said it was actually boiled down to a pretty simple principle. He said he looked at a lot of financial analysts around him, and they would often come to a theory about the value of a company. And then they would slowly, over time, primarily just look for information that confirmed that hypothesis. And he said instead what he would do is he would work hard to come to a theory about the value of a company, and then he would work twice as hard after that to look for information that told him he was wrong. He called it asking disaffirming questions. He came to a theory, and then he asked disaffirming questions, and what he would end up with is a significantly higher confidence that he had the right company. Some of us never get around to asking disconfirming questions. We slowly decide what we want truth to be, and then we disallow anything that tells us otherwise. We just want something that tells us that all our choices are okay. You know, the fact is, somehow, some way, someone told us that truth will always make us feel good about ourselves. And we've bought it. And so what we do is we say, yes, yes, I am on a quest for truth. Until I find truth that tells me I need to forgive that spouse that walked out on me 3 years ago, I can't take that truth. Or yes, I'm on a quest for truth. Until it tells me that maybe I need to share my resources beyond me, I can't handle that truth. Or yes, I'm on an honest quest for truth. Until it tells me that God has a higher plan for sex than me having sex with anybody that I want. No, I can't take that truth. We don't want uncomfortable truth. And so we don't find truth. We find the mirror. And God says the dangerous place where we find ourselves at is this. The book of 2 Timothy in the New Testament, it says, "For the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they'll gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear." The fact is, if we are going to be honest seekers of truth, whether it's in here or wherever your journey takes you, you need to keep this question alive. Is truth always comfortable? And you need to be open to responding to the truth that you believe with change if necessary. We need to be willing to accept uncomfortable truth. A lot of us saw the Lord of the Rings this summer. Well, J.R. Tolkien, who created The Lord of the Rings, one of his best friends was my favorite author, C.S. Lewis. And both of them created these fantasy series of stories. Tolkien created The Lord of the Rings, and Lewis created The Chronicles of Narnia. I've been reading the first book from The Chronicles of Narnia. It's called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I've been reading that to my son this summer. And in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's this fantasy tale. It's kind of an allegory. And the image of God in the book is portrayed by the lion. And the lion's name is Aslan. And there comes a point in the book where the children have stepped into this magical land. And they're interacting with the animals and they're hearing about Aslan, who's the king of this world. And Mr. and Mrs. Beaver say something to the children that kind of concerns them. They say that, you know, when people step into Aslan's presence, their knees tend to tremble in fear. As a matter of fact, they say that anybody who's in Aslan's presence, who their knees don't tremble a little bit, they're either just braver than most, or they're just plain silly. And one of the kids says, "Well, wait a minute. What are you saying? Are you saying that Aslan's not safe?" The Beaver says, "Haven't you been listening to me? Who said anything about safe? Of course he's not safe. But he's good. He's the king, I tell you." We look for a safe version of God in the mirror. Somebody that will tell us that all our choices are okay. We look for a version that won't ask us to change. And this God that exists asks us to change, and that is anything but safe. It's dangerous. But it's good. That little boy in Bucharest ended up following me around the rest of the time I was there. All day long as I'm working, he'd be following me around, often actually tugging on my leg. And he would follow me around, and the only thing he'd say to me the whole time is, "Leve, leve, leve, leve." Follow me around the whole time, tugging on my leg, "Leve, leve." And I didn't, you know, only spoke a couple words of Romanian. I didn't know what he was saying. So after about the third day of this, I asked my Romanian roommate. I said, "You know what, I'm wondering if he's saying, you know, hey, silly man, you're holding that jackhammer upside down, you know, or something like that." I said, "Roommate, what does leve mean?" He said, oh, that's simple. Leve, it just means pick me up. He just wants you to hold him. And so the rest of the time that I was there, I was able to respond to him. He wanted me to hold him, but he couldn't leap into my arms, so I had to bend down and I had to pick him up. See, the good news about this God is, yes, he is dangerous. He's not safe. But he doesn't require us to jump up into his arms. This God that has a dangerous change for us wants to bend down and pick us up. And all he asks is that we be honest with our questions. All he asks is that we say leve. And he meets us where we're at. He doesn't make us work our way into his arms over the course of several lifetimes. He doesn't make us adhere to every little rule as a way to getting into his arms. He just says, be honest with me and I will come to you. Not after you get all cleaned up, but in the dirt and in the problems and in the pain, I reach down and pick you up. And that's what we find with this dangerous God. If we ask real questions. I hope Crossroads can be a place that you can do that. Let's pray. God, I ask that for me and everyone else in here, you would keep us at that dangerous place where we're asking real questions. And give us the courage to stay there. In Jesus' name.